In Latin America, they tell a story about a peasant farmer whose hobby was raising fighting roosters. Each year he entered them in cockfights during the fiesta time in a village some kilometres from his home. On one particular occasion, Don Manuel was especially proud of two birds which he had patiently trained throughout the year, with high hopes that one of them would win top honours in the annual competition. On the morning of the contest, he trussed up each of his prize fowl, carefully binding their legs so they would survive the trip to town without harming themselves or each other. Then he carefully placed them in the boot of his battered old car and drove slowly to the scene of the competition in order not to excite his potential champions on the way. He was confident that he would return home that night with a blue ribbon and a cash prize. When he arrived at the cockpit, the crowds were already gathering for the day's contests. He parked his car near the scene of action and excitedly opened the boot of the car, already dreaming of how he would spend that prize money. He was utterly unprepared for the sight that greeted him. Somehow the cocks had broken free of their bonds and the boot was a sorry sight of blood, chook, flesh and feathers. It was immediately evident that neither of his prized possessions would survive to participate in the competition that day. Heartbroken, Manuel surveyed what the two game cocks had done to each other. Tears coursed down his weathered cheeks, and the only sound that escaped from his mouth was a pathetic explanation. "It's too bad I didn't tell them they were both on the same team. Yes, it's too bad I didn't tell them they were both on the same team." Thank you for your welcome and invitation tonight. You know, as fellow citizens of this old world, sometimes it's just too bad we're not reminded that we're on the same team. And yet we still have our differences. Diversity of opinion can be helpful if we can agree to disagree without being disagreeable. Not easy, is it? Tonight we're going to talk about dealing with conflict. Conflict resolution. Genesis chapter 4. You know, there's an interesting story in the Bible, and although it really happened, it's a parable of the way that God deals with us today. To say that Joseph was treated unfairly by his brothers would be an understatement. He was torn from his father's heart, thrown into a pit, sold into slavery, falsely accused and bound in prison, all due initially to the jealousy of his brothers. We know too the story of how God turned the circumstances to the good of the trusting Joseph. You remember how he revealed himself to his brothers when he was an Egyptian governor? In Genesis 45 verse 24 he says an interesting thing to his brothers as they're about to return home to bring Joseph's father to Egypt. Joseph tells them, quote, "not to quarrel along the way." But what about when we really can't agree? What about when the heat is on? What about when we even can't agreeably agree to disagree? Well, let's look at our overhead. Dealing with conflict. Conflict can be dealt with in one of eight ways. These are the ways of the buzzard, the budgie, the ostrich, the peacock, the sparrow, the gnu bird, the goose, and the rooster. Let me go through those a little more slowly. Although the buzzard is a raptor, that's a bird of prey, when it sees conflict it simply hovers above at a safe distance until the conflict has died down and then comes in for whatever pickings are left. The budgie, sometimes known as the kissing love bird, meets you halfway. It compromises freedom for food, compromises what is best for what is okay. One way of dealing with conflict is compromise. The ostrich, yes, that's right, yes. Yes, renowned for hiding its head in the sand and blissfully ignoring conflict as if it didn't exist. Yes, that's right. Yes, another way of dealing with conflict. The peacock, peacock struts around, ignoring the dangers, and is interested only in parading itself and saying, I'm number one, what I say goes, and I'm not even interested in discussing it. Yes, that's another way of dealing with conflict. The sparrow, the timid little sparrow, he's really chicken. He chooses one of fight or flight, one of those responses, and then little sparrow flees away as far from the conflict as possible. The gunu bird of North America is a giver-upper. It resigns itself to any circumstances. Native Americans, that's what they call the Indians nowadays, Native Americans don't have to hunt the gunu. When they see one of these rare creatures, they simply walk up to it and pick it up. It's a giver-upper. When conflict comes, it just gives up. Some of us deal with conflict that way too, don't we? The goose, on the other hand, confronts conflict, even supposed conflict, head on, irrespective of circumstances, consequences, or dangers. The goose is the farmer's best watchdog. No one wins but the goose, no matter who is right. Do you know people that deal with conflict that way? But the humble rooster, now we mentioned it a little bit earlier on in our story, but really, you know, the rooster, even though the rooster is equipped to fight to the death, he's a literal war machine with spurs on each leg, talon claws, scissor beak. In a normal farmyard, for the sake of his own feathers as well as for his brood, he tries to avoid blood conflict, this combat of blood. And when this fighting machine is controlled, he's the harbinger of the dawn, the most beautiful and welcome creature on the farm. You see, the rooster doesn't avoid confrontation. He still struts his comb in the air and wobbles his wattles, but he seeks ways of confrontation other than bloodshed, especially if it's likely to be his blood that's shed. Today we're going to learn how to resolve conflict. You know, other seminars may teach you how to not to fight. Today I'm going to teach you how to fight. Not a cockfight, no, not with dripping blood and gory flesh and scattered feathers, not with claws, not even with words or weapons of warfare, but with tools. Seven of them. Seven tried and tested tailored-tempered tools for fighting with a peaceful resolution in mind. When we use these tools, fighting is constructive, not destructive, affirming, not demeaning, creative and not reactive. So let's call this creative fighting. Here are the seven tools for creative fighting. Egbert had a busy day at the office. Due to no fault of his own, two major sales had been lost that day, but he had copped the blame for both of them. In his frustration, he left his small change purse at work and presented an irate bus driver with a $20 banknote in payment for a 70-cent bus fare. And slipping on Junior's marbles at the doorstep, well, that would have been the last straw had it not been for the thought of a peaceful evening in front of the TV. How welcoming. Well, that was when Maggie greeted him so excitedly at the door with all the burdens of her hectic day. Yeah, I better let your imagination fill in the details. What with a broken washing machine and kids screaming, and well, you know. So the first tool for creative fighting then is to choose a suitable time and place. Whether it's a conflict between spouses, between parents and children, between peers, between fellow club or church members, the same tool can be utilised. When God confronted Elijah after his bloodthirsty handling of the prophets during the reigns of King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, God waited until Elijah had been well fed. You read this in 1 Kings 19. The angel had actually brought him his food. God waited till he was well fed and well rested, alone in the wilderness, before inviting Elijah's opinions. In contrast, when Paul accused Peter of apostasy, as recorded in Galatians 2, 11 to 14, he says that he did it in front of those he was leading astray. On both occasions, in the wilderness and in front of a group of people, a deliberate time and place were chosen, not to minimize the issue or the confrontation, but to minimize the repercussions, the consequences. So then our first tool is to choose a suitable time and place. Our second tool is to tackle the issue and not each other. Have a look at this overhead here. A short course in not tackling the issue instead of each other. This is Maggie. That's Egbert over there. Maggie. I've got nothing to do all day. I put in three times the hours you do. Doing what? I remember when we used to have real meals, not TV dinners. You agreed on TV dinners when I took the part-time job, says Maggie. You're as unreasonable as your mother. I suppose you've told her about the TV dinners too. Egbert bites back. Well, she asked me how come you were putting on all that weight. And I told her it couldn't be our dinners because TV trays don't hold enough food to feed a cat. Now you don't love me. All you want is a housekeeper who cooks like your mother. You're cruel, boo-hoo-hoo. You're mean, boo-hoo-hoo. Yes, tackling the issue instead of each other. Well, that's what they're doing there. They're tackling each other instead of the issue. Let's look at a couple of issues that come part of this here. One is name calling and the other is actually attacking the person. You know, name calling is not such a bad idea. In fact, I think it's a great idea, providing it's part of God's plan. That means to say, the name that you call the person affirms or uplifts. The angel who fought with Gideon called him a mighty man of valor. When Abraham argued with God about his lack of a family, God called him the father of many nations and his wife Sarah the mother of many peoples. When Jonah the Jew fled from the idea of making peace in Gentile Nineveh, God called him the dove of peace. When Peter quivered in his faith and denied Jesus, God called him a rock. And I'm sure you can think of many other examples. Secondly, we consider attacks on the person. And that little overhead we had a minute ago with Maggie and Egbert gives you an idea of an attack on the person. You know, J.B. Priestley, in one of his plays, makes the following observation. He says it was one of his characters. She was not very pretty, but she might have been handsome if someone had kept telling her she was pretty. Attacking the person and not the problem is like bulldozing a house to get rid of a spider in the kitchen. Attacking the issue. Attack the issue and not each other. In Matthew 7, 1 and 2, the Living Bible paraphrases Jesus' words by saying, "Don't criticize, and then you won't be criticized, for others will treat you as you treat them. And why worry about a speck in your brother's eye when you have a board in your own?" Hypocrite. First get rid of the board, and then you can see to help your brother. Note, Jesus didn't say to remove the spike from your brother's eye and poke it in your brother's eye, did he? Verse 12 continues. Do for others what you want them to do for you. This is the teaching of the law of Moses in a nutshell. Yes, that's a good question. Maybe we'll answer that. Look, we'll just sidestep just a little here, and we'll confirm what we mean by attacking the problem or the issue, and then we'll come back and finish off our tools for creative fighting. There are 8 basic considerations in attacking any problem. Let me just take this piece of paper here. Now I'm just going to draw a little dot in the middle of the page. Right, now I'll hold this up for you to see. What do you see here? Yes? Okay, now most of you saw a little dot, and rightly so. However, I didn't hold up a little dot. I held up a whole piece of paper with a little dot in the middle. What I'm illustrating here is that we need to be able to see the whole picture, the whole forest, and not just one tree. So, number one then is consider the whole forest. In the church at Philippi, the Apostle Paul had observed a great degree of unity in his letters to the Philippians. In Philippians 4, 2 and 3, he said, "I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to agree with each other in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, loyal yoke fellow, help these women who have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life." Okay, this is Philippians 4, 2 and 3. That's right, yes. Paul here tackled the issue head on. He affirmed these two ladies by referring to their past good works, and yet he didn't beat around the bush. So firstly, we need to consider the whole forest, and secondly, we need to consider, in tackling any problem, don't beat around the bush. In any dispute, the fact is that neither participant is likely to be without at least some blame. Yes, I guess this ought to make us very slow to pass judgment, especially as often the facts aren't all before us. Although he called these two women by name, Paul spoke with compassion. He was neither censoring nor vindictive. Well, let's ask some questions. Was he too far removed from the problem? Or did he fear getting caught in the middle if he took sides? Well, that's right. Taking sides would have surely polarized both these two women and the church as well. Was Paul merely tactful? Yes, or maybe Paul knew that when two people come in conflict, the blame seldom rests exclusively with one adversary. A third consideration then is to be a participant or mediator if you're not directly involved, and not to be a judge. When people come in conflict, the blame seldom rests exclusively with one adversary. Okay, number four, fourth consideration when dealing with conflict, and that is to give praise before blame. When John was in exile on the Isle of Patmos, he wrote under the Spirit's guidance to the 7 churches in Asia Minor. We can read these letters in the first few chapters of Revelation. Although some of these letters contain strong rebuke, they begin with commendation and praise and end with the promise of rewards. These are rewards to the overcomers. What a lesson for us. Begin with praise. Give praise first, and then blame. Going back to Euodia and Syntyche for a moment. Paul did more than withhold blame. He praised them for the support that they had for the gospel's sake. Philippians chapter 4, 2 and 3. Number 5, Place responsibility where it belongs. Paul placed the responsibility for reconciliation squarely and equally on both women. He reminded them that they were in the Lord and that God had a contribution to make too. In her book Walking on Water, Madeline Ingle reminded an interviewer, "I have a point of view, you have a point of view, but God has view." So place responsibility where it belongs. So we'll just review those quickly. Consider the whole forest, don't beat around the bush, avoid judging, give praise before blame, place responsibility where it belongs, and sixthly, bring in a third party. In this case, Paul's story, he mentioned the law yoke fellow. Now this involves certain cautions, and we'll discuss this in greater detail later, so I won't spend the time on it just now. But finally, be sensitive. Paul didn't go into any of the details of the conflict between these two women, although he no doubt knew a lot more than he said in his letter. So we have this caution to be sensitive.